Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome to the Politics Guys with your hosts, Jay Parson and Michael Baranowski.
Hello, and welcome to the Politics Guys. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My co-host this week is, as always, Cleveland attorney and sometime Republican strategist Jay Carson, the man to see for all your commercial litigation needs. On Tuesday, the Senate approved the Orwellian-sounding USA Freedom Act, which supposedly curtailed the federal government's power to collect bulk phone records and opened up the secret court process at least a little bit. What do you think about this, Jay?
I think I think you're exactly right calling it Orwellian named, and I wish Congress would just stop doing that. Sort of the idea that, you know, Patriot Act didn't sound like a little creepy, so we'll call it USA Freedom Act. Better it would be to call it something like the U.S. Data Collection Protocol Act.
So well, that sounds exciting.
Knows what we're talking about. Yeah, but again, it's a little less creepy, and you're sort of calling it what it is. On the merits of it, you know, look, I think it's good that we're revisiting this a little bit. I do believe that the data collection is something that is needed, and I think most of the intelligence and military folks have said that this is helpful. And what we're talking about isn't listening to everyone's phone calls. Simply collecting metadata. That said, there ought to be protections in place as to how that data is kept and accessed down the road, and I think there ought to be a court process, and that court process doesn't necessarily have to be open because we don't really have that in the criminal sense, but I think there needs to be some sort of judicial sign off before these things are used.
Yeah, see, I think a lot of things are potentially helpful in the war on terror, but a lot of these things we have to balance that, you know, our freedoms, our privacy rights against this. And, essentially this really doesn't change things a whole lot for the NSA. All it means now is under this new law that instead of the NSA directly getting this metadata, that the phone companies hold this metadata and then the NSA can get access to it on essentially fairly flimsy pretenses. And so it's basically not a big deal. Essentially, it seems to me the only difference is that the phone companies are doing the storage for the NSA. But go ahead.
Well, that's not entirely different, though, than what the system was before. And I do think there is some protection there in terms of what the phone companies collect and save. For example, you can always subpoena records from any sort of third-party internet provider or phone provider to the extent that they keep them. And to get those records, through a subpoena, even in a civil matter, you don't need a really big showing to do that. And also in most of these cases, what you would need to show some sort of probable cause. And again, that's a pretty easy hurdle to get over most of the time. But there needs to be a hurdle nevertheless.
Yeah, but now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court doesn't operate quite like a regular court does, right?
No. It's all very secret proceedings. But again, there's not a tremendous difference between that and, you go into chambers and get a warrant for a wiretap or something like that. Again, that wouldn't be a public proceeding. It would all be done quietly. Now, I guess probably the best thing that you could do is see that those records are unsealed and made available at some time in the future.
Right. And they're supposedly under this new law, they're doing a little bit of that. But for the most part, this court is still cloaked in secrecy. And I understand that the proponents say, well, we have to do that for security reasons. But of course, that's always what the state says when it wants to take away our freedoms and keep things from us, that it's for our own good to keep the bad people from getting information. And, you know, of course, none of this would have happened. We wouldn't even have seen this USA Freedom Act if Edward Snowden hadn't released the information that he did, illegally, of course, to start this whole thing rolling. And so I don't have a whole lot of trust in the NSA and the National Security Establishment, given what we've learned in the last few years.
Well, and I'm really not that far apart from you on that. You know me, I certainly don't trust the government. But I do think that the FISA court, there's something there. There is another safeguard. Now, we can talk about whether that safeguard is enough or ought to be more, or there ought to be sort of another level of review beyond that. But no, I think I share your libertarian concern about this. I don't know that. I guess I'm trying to think what would be the next best step to add another layer of protection, and I can't come up with one. So
right now, there have been a number of studies that have been done on the effects of this metadata collection and these measures, and it seems like they found almost time after time that there's really no evidence that these things ever thwarted a terrorist attack. Though that's sort of a tough thing to prove, I guess. Essentially. Yeah. So now it's interesting that Kentucky's Senate delegation was sort of very split on this issue, with Mitch McConnell being hugely disappointed that the Patriot Act was changed at all. And of course, on the other end, you had Rand Paul, who was sort of leading the charge against this sort of thing. So I definitely lean more toward the Rand Paul side on this issue.
I would say in this case, first of all, I'll do the snarky aside and say I didn't even realize they had metadata in Kentucky. But I think it's one of these, the process is working, where you've got somebody who is arguing the side of, we need this, it's important for our national security, here's what we need to do to make it work. And you've got somebody sort of being the essentially public defender in Rand Paul. So excuse me. So if I were to come down on the side of this, I'd say I'm probably more leaning on the McConnell side. But that's not to say I don't appreciate what Rand Paul's doing, and what he's doing is important and necessary.
Okay. Yeah.
If that makes sense. I mean, it sounds like sort of a cop out. But I think sometimes we just look at a process and pick sides, and sometimes what you want is the argument. It's not even necessarily, tremendously important who wins at the end, but as long as you're having that argument, that in itself is a safeguard.
No, I agree with that, actually. And I think what Rand Paul is doing actually is, if you look at it from a non-cynical perspective, is actually, in a sense, sort of courageous in that it doesn't necessarily help his chances in 2016. He spent the last year or so trying to make up with Mitch McConnell and the Republican establishment to try to pave his way for, at least, if not support, certainly not condemnation before his presidential run. And now some have argued that he puts some of that in jeopardy with what he's done.
Yeah, I think he is he's standing by his convictions, and you can agree or disagree with those. But I think that's good. As far as hurting his presidential chances, I mean, my thought is, look, I don't know what his chances were, regardless. But I think, and I think we've said before, one of the points of his run, I think, is less to win the nomination than to put out this sort of libertarian view. And be sort of the voice of the libertarian right on a lot of these issues. So I think he's succeeding in doing that. He was never going to have the Republican establishment embrace him in any event. So I think he's sort of it makes sense with him for him from an ideological perspective, and I don't think it overly hurts him politically. Yeah. I mean, it's going to anger some people, but those people would be mad at him anyway. So.
Yeah, I would agree. He's not a, he's certainly not a front runner. He's maybe in the second group of candidates. And of course, there are only 239 days till the Iowa caucuses. So, you know, it's time's short here. But
right. And there's also only probably 150 Republican candidates, I think, in the race at this point. So, you know,
right now, I looked it up. Right now, there are 10 announced candidates. That would be in alphabetical order: Carson, Cruz, Fiorina, Graham, Huckabee, Pataki, Paul, Perry, Rubio, Santorum, and four, we could call them likely candidates: Bush, Christie, Jindal, and Walker. So
right.
14 probably before all's said and done. And on the Democratic side, we have four who are announced: Chafee, Clinton, O'Malley, and Sanders, and one potential candidate in Jim Webb. So, you know, it's, I think, though, on the GOP side, we have this, you know, huge number of candidates. But really, I think there are only three candidates who have a legitimate shot at the nomination. And Rand Paul isn't one of them.
Right. Right. So no, I would agree.
So I think it's in the end, it's going to come down to Bush, Walker, and Rubio.
Well, that's probably a good. Do we want to switch gears and talk presidential politics for a little bit now?
Sure. We seem to be. So why don't we just go right into that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what are your, I guess you've already said this, on the crowded primary, you know, my biggest concern is, to quote James Taranto from the Wall Street Journal, he's got the little blog where one of the running gags is, I blame George W. Bush. In this case, I blame Jeb Bush for not really getting out there and raising money and sort of closing out the field early. I mean, I think that is why you have so many people jumping in is, everyone assumed that he would sort of suck up all the money and we'd be talking about a much narrower field of candidates, but he hasn't. So it's people are looking at this and saying, hey, it's anybody's game and why not?
Well, one of the interesting things about the Bush strategy is it can really help him, at least early on, in raising money. I think that's why he did it, because once he formally declares his candidacy, all of a sudden he's subject to FEC limits. But right now, he can work with super PACs and directly and raise unlimited amounts of money, which I think is his plan, essentially. And it's essentially, well, now it's basically a farce. Everyone knows he's running as long as he doesn't say it. And one point he actually slipped up and said, I'm running, and then quickly corrected himself, if I run, because he doesn't want to be bound by the FEC. Not that the FEC really has much authority. It's kind of a toothless thing these days.
Well, and not as if it's not a matter of if he just says I'm running, if that FEC limits actually necessarily kick in, then he has to actually start a file petitions and start a campaign committee and so forth. But I mean, you may be right, but regardless, even if we're talking super PAC money, if that super PAC money were all going to Jeb Bush, or there was a sense that that's where it was all headed, I think you still would not see this many people jumping into the race.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree that he didn't have that aura of inevitability like Hillary Clinton does on the Democratic side. So, which, you know, I still expect him to be the nominee, though I wouldn't be surprised if it ends up being Scott Walker.
Okay.
So who do you see as being the, would you agree, Bush, Walker, and Rubio, or is there someone else you see?
I think Bush, Walker, Rubio, I think that makes sense, because there are certain sort of, there's sort of categories. There's sort of your Midwestern governor category, and I'd lump Christie into that, even though he's not really a Midwesterner. But you've got, you know, Walker, Kasich, Christie, that is that sort of mold. You've got the centered kind of mold, which would be Cruz, Rubio. I'm not sure who else would necessarily fit in there. There's sort of the social conservative wing with your Huckabees and Santorums, who I don't think either of them really gain any traction. You know, this time out.
I didn't mention Kasich before. I wish he would run. I don't think he'd make it through the primaries, but if he somehow ran and made it through the primaries, he would actually be the first Republican that I might conceivably vote for in a presidential election in a number of years. And it would be nice for me to feel like I had a choice. You know, but I don't really see him. I don't think he's going to run. I know some people think that he may, but I don't see that happening. What do you think?
The signs that I've been getting all would point to him running. I mean, that said, I mean, I've got a little bit of, I don't know if it's insider information. I wouldn't really call it that, but, you know, more than what's printed in newspapers, but not a lot more. And I don't know that anybody can tell you a definitive yes, he's running or not. But if I had to guess, I would say he will. Now, again, he may run just to get in and go for a second spot, or his big issue. And I don't know that the press has picked up on this. He's been pushing a balanced budget amendment, which sounds sort of retro, I guess, these days. But that's, you know, he may use this as a platform to sort of push for that, much as you've got Rand Paul pushing on the libertarian, you know, issues.
I might like that if he can get a VP nomination and then do a Frank Underwood thing, kind of push the president out and end up being that would be okay. I don't know. Anyway, so this week there have been a couple of announcements, new people throwing their hat into the ring. On the Republican side, we see a retread from 2012. That's Rick Perry.
Yeah. And I don't know what to make of that. I think a lot of the press says Perry's got a lot of really sharp policy people lined up behind him. My concern is, you know, has the Rick Perry moment passed?
I don't even know that there was much of a Rick Perry moment.
Well,
I think
there was, you know, 4 years ago when people were looking at the economy and Texas is the I almost said Texas is the country that's adding the most jobs, but I'm sort of right on that. Texas was the state that was adding more jobs by a tremendous margin than any place else in the country. Most of that due to oil and gas stuff,
yeah.
But since you know markets have changed, that's leveled off a little bit. He doesn't really have that claim to stake on the, you know, being the necessary driver of economic development.
Also,
whereas Kasich actually does have a pretty good claim on that, on job creation.
Say also, last time Perry was running, he wasn't facing two felony indictments.
Yeah, that never helps.
No.
But you know, we have to do another show on this sort of the criminalization of politics. My sense is those indictments are sort of non-starters from what I've read. I mean, as far as actually getting an actual conviction, and they're politically broad. And if anything, that sort of helps him in a primary.
I could see where that would be the case. Yeah, and just for those who haven't followed this, he was indicted on abuse of power and coercion after he threatened to and then actually did carry out a veto on state funding for public corruption prosecutors.
Yeah, and to me, that's sort of the crime of governing while Republican. You know, I don't see that there was any corruption, because look, he used his power as governor. He said that's what he was going to do, and that's what he did. That's politics. That's not criminal.
Yeah, it doesn't really seem very, very solid to me either. He's also playing up his military experience, which normally, at least in the past, there have been a lot of Republicans who've had plenty of military experience, but not so much these days. Although I want to point out that Rick Perry's military experience was in the Air Force, which I guess we have to qualify as the military, kind of, sort of. But
well, we should, yeah, full disclosure that you were a Marine, of course, and
the actual military as opposed to the Air Force.
The only real military we have, I would suppose, right?
The Army, I would say. And then, you know, there's taking the far behind would be the Navy, and then the Air Force, bringing up the rear slightly ahead of the Coast Guard and the Postal Service, I guess.
Right.
Yeah, but anyway, so Rick Perry. And then on the Democrat side, we had Lincoln Chafee announce.
Yeah.
People saying, Lincoln who? That's Lincoln. I think he's got a slightly worse chance than Bernie Sanders.
Right. It's kind of funny. It's the Lincoln Chafee and Bernie Sanders are sort of fishing from the same stream there too. Sort of a pristine New England Vermont stream where stoned hippies lay around and eat Ben and Jerry's. But no, I don't see Lincoln Chafee getting much traction.
Well, he does have that, you know, that amazing Rhode Island power base, which really, what else do you need? So yeah, I don't think he's much of a threat. The media is trying to build up Sanders as a threat to Hillary Clinton, and he is a little bit more of a you can make a better case for him as a threat because Chafee used to be a Republican, and so right. he's a moderate in the sense that Hillary Clinton is, whereas Sanders is coming at things very much from Hillary Clinton's left, kind of like what Elizabeth Warren would have done had she chosen to run. But this idea
sort of like Stalin or sort of like Lenin did to Kerensky,
I can see where you'd
make that argument, yeah,
There was an article in the New York Times arguing that Bernie Sanders has momentum, which it just really momentum doesn't matter a whole lot if you don't have the money people behind you. And I don't really think he has that momentum. They based that on a big crowd that he got at Iowa. And you can compare that. I guess he has momentum compared to Lincoln Chafee, where apparently when he announced, there was a crowd of around 100 people. Most of them apparently were students, and many of the students said they had to attend for a class.
I'll point out something I think it's kind of funny about momentum, particularly or big crowds, particularly with Democrat versus Republican candidates. Lots of times the farther out the candidate is, the bigger crowd they draw. For example, Ron Paul was always famous or infamous for winning the CPAC straw poll. And also putting in really big numbers when he ran and Rand also in the early primaries, and a lot of these kind of I don't want to say fringe candidates, but
you could say
farther front fringe, yeah, candidates tend to attract bigger crowds simply because they appeal to people without a lot to do. to put it bluntly, I mean, for example, students who have free time or the unemployed or the people who are sort of living in mom's basement. And, I'm a very busy guy, and I'd like to get out to, attend a Kasich or a Rubio event or something like that. But, you know, man, I got to work. I got to get the kids places. I got all this, you know? So, yeah, I think Bernie Sanders has sort of the Occupy Wall Street people who could go and can go and show up just because, well, they got nothing else to do.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to. I don't know that attending a rally for anyone would be high on my list of priorities, even if I had the free time. But certainly, I don't think that those crowds.
Democrats are so much better than that. The Republicans, even. Yeah, I mean, you guys all show up, and you got the bongo drums, and it's a big communal thing, and. Republicans tend not to like crowds and that sort of thing. So, yeah.
Of course, there is the Tea Party. Then your people don't have much of anything to do, tend to be the retirees.
No, I would say that. That sort of proves my point. Again, that's the more fringy sort of folks.
Okay.
Who again, don't necessarily have a lot or have more time on their hands than they know what to do with. So they can dress up in 18th century outfits and wave Gadsden flags and so forth. So
I think in the end, though, and I may have made this prediction before, I still see things as being a race between Bush and Clinton, with Clinton ending up winning.
Well, we have time to talk final predictions down the road.
Yeah,
I certainly think Bush is in the top tier of Republican contenders as we move through the primary season. So,
okay, well, you know, let's move on to something maybe a little bit lighter. There's been a big scandal in the last couple of weeks in my little world of political science. I don't know if you've heard about this, but
I didn't really hear about it till you told me about it, and I'm a little ashamed because I try to be well read and keep up with stuff, But no, this is a little poli-sci geeky here.
Yeah, there's definitely a political angle to it. There was a graduate student at UCLA who was interested in polling and opinion formation and very geeky political science stuff like that. But he had this theory that if you sent out people to ask about, to talk to folks about gay marriage, that if they were really committed, the people who were going out, that they could change people's views, or that's what he hoped at least. And sure enough, he found that this was the case. He did this study in 2012, and it got published in this last December in Science, which is a big deal magazine for scientific research.
They even named it Science.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, what else is there to say?
So, I mean, but this was a big deal because it really flew in the face of a lot of prior research. It suggested if you had somebody who went out there to make a case, who was truly committed, that they could change people's minds in a very fundamental and long-lasting way. And there's tons of research in political science and polling that says essentially that people's minds are incredibly hard to change, and you're not going to be able to do it. And that's why this was a big story, because it said, well, no, you actually can. Okay. And this has a major implications, not just for same-sex marriage, but for any other issue you could think of. So if you're interested in, say, legalizing marijuana, well, you'd want to get people out there who are very, strong advocates to make the case and so forth, and maybe that will make a difference. So,
although that's a weird example, and that's a weird sort of, how do you do that, man?
How do you organize them? I understand what you're
exactly.
saying.
Exactly. How do you get really motivated, hey man, you want to go out and, do some polling? In a minute, man. I understand what you're talking about. I just think that example is.
So, yeah, quite possibly not the best example in the world, but the scandal part of it is that recently the study was actually retracted when it came to light that a few researchers who were trying to replicate his findings couldn't. And then they did some digging and found out that he had misrepresented a number of things about the study. And then when people asked to see his data, he said, well, I destroyed it because I had to.
Sure.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Right. And so right now, this guy who had a job waiting for him at Princeton probably doesn't have a job waiting for him at Princeton anymore, now is more or less trying to wildly spin to try to save some shred of his credibility. But the reason why this is a political thing is some people on the right have suggested that, well, he's some, liberal academic who was trying to make a case for gay marriage or something like that, where really I think it's more the case just that he was a desperate graduate student who was trying to get a good job and ended up, lying to try to get that good job, which is really too bad.
Yeah, academics faking research, say it ain't so.
Yeah, I think it happens more often.
I don't see this as any sort of conspiracy. I'm with you. This is sort of a just more the crooked timber of humanity kind of problem than anything else.
Yeah, and I think what people don't realize about academic research is while most of it is not actually faked, almost all of it is, I guess you could say, massaged in some way, shape, or form. There's a lot of ways that you can do things that are perfectly legitimate to make results go a little bit one way or the other. And one of the problems with all scientific research is there's very little replication that's done, running the same experiment again to make sure that you get the same results. Now, you see a lot more of that.
Well, I would say that's even more difficult in social sciences as opposed to the hard sciences.
Yeah,
it's just so much more difficult to have a control for something.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you see a lot more of this replication stuff in, say, drug research when, if you have a wrong answer, people can die. But not so much in social science research, which is why I always, tell people that any given single study in social science, you should totally take with a grain of salt. And unless there's a lot of evidence that's been built up by a bunch of people over many years, it probably isn't very solid at all.
Well, I think that's good advice to your students and listeners. Yeah,
to the world in general. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and I'll tell you, you know much more about the science and the ins and out of polling, but I can tell you just from sort of a practical experience. So often, what you see is, polls are inaccurate because, well, it depends on the question being asked, but. In many cases, they lie, they make stuff up, they don't know. There's the bias of I want to please the interviewer. There is the bias of you're getting people again who might have more free time to respond to your poll than others who don't. So I think that the whole polling science is really pretty inexact on certain issues.
Absolutely.
For example, a poll on when you're talking about something like name recognition or positive, good feeling, bad feeling about a certain candidate, that I think you can have more accuracy on than a question of do you support gay marriage?
Right, because it's
which
so broad.
Which is necessarily
and,
more, sure. a more difficult question, yeah.
Sure. And not only that, but with some of the polls, like the presidential preference sort of things, you have a lot of different organizations polling all at the same time. So you can kind of take a look and get some, you know, pull out some averages, see which polls might be outliers, that sort of thing. Whereas on most issues, that's just not the case.
Yeah.
So that's it for this week's episode. Thanks for listening. If you have any thoughts or comments, we'd love to hear from you. Our email is politicsguys@gmail.com. That's politicsguys, one word, @gmail.com. If you're listening to us on iTunes or Stitcher, we'd really appreciate it if you could take a minute to rate the show and write a quick review. You can follow us throughout the week on the Politics Guys blog, which you can find at our website, politicsguys.com, as well as on Twitter. We'll be back next Sunday. We hope you'll join us.